You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 25th of December, 2025. And listen to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, of course, actually, it is the 25th. We're recording this a few days earlier. But if you're listening to this on Christmas Day, then Merry Christmas to you. And we do have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson with us today, the senior researcher at thebarnesreview.org. And he's here today to talk about his new book, which we haven't actually talked about in depth yet. The book is called Boris Placini Crovew, I believe, and it's subtitled The Foundations and Causes of the Russo-Ukrainian War, 2022 to 2025. So I would expect there to be all the details that you need to find out exactly what is going on over there and why it's going on over there. So Matt, do you want to start off by telling us how you started the book off? I mean, how far back do the foundations of the war go? Do they go back like a century, or is this just recently to do with NATO and NATO's encroachment on the East? Where do you start off with this subject in the book?
Well, I start off with it, you know, fairly recently. Even though I could go back to the Middle Ages, I don't. I have a section there on Alexander Dugin's point of view, which goes back a little further, but it's short. For the most part, it goes back to 2014, the Maidan Revolution was just in Kiev, and the government that brought it to power, and of course, who financed it.
And which was the government that brought it to power then? You're referring to America there?
The US, NATO, the EU. You got to remember, you can't study anything in Ukraine since 2014, or really since 2004, with this belief that Ukraine is an independent country. It's not. It's to a great extent a colony of these Western powers. Its economy is so badly run that it is dependent entirely on Western assistance for everything. And as I've said many times, the only good it has to the West is to act as a battering ram against Russia, who the West hates for many reasons that we know, but I even wonder if the politicians know. So it's a symbolic other that they despise. But the title you mentioned the Ukraine. I wrote it in the Ukrainian rather than the Russian. Simply means debts paid in blood. In other words, the debt of the Ukrainian society economy has been so high, there's no money to repay it. State assets have all been sold off. The land has been taken. What's left? The blood of your men. And that's exactly how they're repaying their debt.
What was Ukraine in debt to Russia then when all this started? I mean, what was the reason why it sort of leaned in towards the European Union? And we know there are a lot of Russian speakers in Ukraine, mainly in the Donbass area. They wanted to stay with Russia. But in the West, you've got non-Russian speakers who appear to support the government and appear to support this push towards moving to the EU. So I guess there's two real questions. Why do the people in the West support the EU and the people in the East support Russia? And why was it that the government of the Ukraine wanted to pivot towards the European Union? Did it have anything to do with debt to Russia by any chance?
Well, that certainly was relevant. They went to the court in Sweden and yeah, they had to pay it. Most of the industry in Ukraine is Russian. or otherwise, you know, some in the West, it's otherwise foreign, but in the East, it's Russian. Nuclear power plants are all either Russian or Soviet, you know. That's the first element to it. And it's not the only element to it.
Tell us about the other elements then.
Concerning why the West wanted this war.
Well, the reason why the people in the West support pivoting towards the EU rather than sticking with Russia with what they knew. Why have they sort of turned their backs on their neighbor? I mean, what's the reason for that?
Oh, you mean in the west of Ukraine?
Yes.
Okay. Well, there never was any hatred of Russia in even Western Ukraine. I've researched this to a great extent, all the poll data and everything else. But since the media is completely in state hands, and the stories, you know, I could read both of them, Russian and Ukrainian, okay. They are very similar, I'm sorry to say. But maybe the propaganda has done this. You know, they're struggling with extreme poverty. See, I don't understand how anyone would support the West in Western Ukraine, Western Europe, that is to say, because liberalism is what destroyed this economy in the first place. Ukraine has it all. They have a well-educated population. The country up until the war started had more people with advanced degrees than any other country in the world, with their universities being based either on the British or the German model. They have access, of course, to the Black Sea, so they have sea access. They have tons of resources. They have excellent land. They should be a very, very powerful first world economy today. But that's not what the West had in store for them.
And surely there must have been some corruption problems before this 2014 Maidan revolution. I mean, I know it was sort of centered in Kiev and not so much in the rest of the country. But there must have been disagreements with the way that Ukraine was actually being run at the time. What were these sort of disagreements? What happened with that original government when the revolution took place?
I'm talking about President Yanukovych.
Yeah.
Who I wrote, I think I'm the only guy to write a summary of his political point of view in English. And it's on the Occidental Observer somewhere. Of course there's going to be corruption. Ukraine is saddled with it. Ever since the oligarchs were able to take over, everyone, whether you have a good will or you have a bad will, you have to deal with them. Putin was smart. Lukashenko was smart. They went to prison or they fled the country. The corruption comes from the fact that when state institutions were privatized, those that were already powerful or had access to capital from around the world took them over. It's not as bad as it was in Albania, but this group was overwhelmingly Jewish. The people surrounding Zelensky are completely Jewish. Not so much the case with Yanukovych. You can even go back to 2004 with the Orange Revolution. So I followed to a great extent. It wasn't create a new government, but it was there to protect those who, if they didn't win, they would go to prison. It's kind of like Netanyahu, people like Timoshenko, one of these Jewish oligarchs. You know, they function for their own interests, for their own needs, for their own purposes. They have no connection to the nation. Even if they weren't Jewish, an oligarch would have no connection to the nation. They don't believe in it. And so, yeah, this is a relatively new phenomenon. And there was no attempt. I mean, I always said, you had to have a military coup. But the military was allowed to decay. You know, in Albania, there hardly is a military there anymore because it's a threat to them. It's a threat to the criminal gangs that run it, especially the northern part. Why the military continues to permit all of this to happen is a mystery. They're going against their very own oath. But that's the only thing that's going to stop it is the military coup. But this goes back a long way. And of course, the Soviet era, was a tyranny, was death camps and everything else. But afterwards, the U.S. was talking about this wonderful new economy, this market economy but it was strictly oligarchical and heavily Jewish. And I think the Jewish element was a big one that allowed the regime to really get close to them. So, that's the deal, I think, in a nutshell.
So if they started off and they didn't have a very big army and they weren't able to have a sort of military coup, and then you had the Maidan Revolution, which was funded by America and the West, and Victoria Nuland is on that recording, isn't she, talking about who she wanted to be running Ukraine, basically. America were the ones that put Petro Poroshenko in power, and I think it was Arseniy something or other was the other guy that they put in power.
Yeah.
So how do they go from that, from having a military that's too weak to actually take power, to being in the situation where they are today, where I believe in last week's episode you were saying that in Ukraine there would be the third largest army in NATO if they were in NATO, or the third largest army in the European Union. So how do they go from having a really, really weak military base, too weak to have a military coup, to now having all this army fighting for them and willing to lay down their lives? I mean, you said something like there were 2 million men that had died, 2 million Ukrainians. So how do they go from that? How do they get to that situation?
Well, we know that in 2014, the military was beaten by the militias in the east, Luhansk and Donetsk. I was the first one to translate their declarations of independence. And constitutions into English. No one quite understood the importance of what was happening there. This national renaissance. I don't know if it was too weak prior to that. They certainly had the infantry and everything else, but they didn't have the will, and they didn't want to upset the Americans. But after their defeat, in late 2014, the U.S. came in and said, okay, we're going to rebuild this entirely. Because now you had an independent Eastern corridor that were not, they're not Ukrainians in any way. Russia has been assisting them and for non-military means. And the West, NATO, created a huge military apparatus. Very artificially, very... trained and all over the globe, in fact, in Brussels, in France, in the U.S. That you had Ukrainian SEALs being trained in the U.S. But with all of that, the U.S. with in an impoverished country. That's what killed me about the whole thing. All this money they're pouring it into the military when they're in dire poverty. People don't realize how bad it was in roughly from 93, well, to today. And they're trying to blame the war for their poverty. It's not. This has always been the case. Ukraine doesn't have a functional economy. It doesn't have a functional currency. This was something that was built by, we'll support you. We'll do whatever you want, the U.S. says to them. So long as you act as a barrier to Russia, so long as you act as a battering ram against the Russian Federation. It was the same thing with Albania. You attack the Serbs, we'll look the other way for everything else you do. And corruption is already built into such a system.
Well, one question that people might have is, you say that there's a lot of these Jewish oligarchs, Zelensky himself is Jewish, and yet it was these militias that went up against the people in the Donbass region, and it was the militias that sort of took over the military, and the militias, I believe they were the right sector was one of them, and there was the Azov battalion, and these are supposedly quote-unquote Nazi militias, yet they are fighting for Zelensky, who is Jewish, who, as you say, is surrounded by Jewish advisors and Jewish oligarchs. And that doesn't really add up, does it? Well, I mean, what's going on there?
But that's why you have to specialize in these areas. It doesn't make any sense on paper, but given Soviet and Russian Ukrainian history, it does. These militias, first of all, many of them were trained in Israel. They put on an act. They realized that there's a huge nationalist strain that they had to canal into a different area. How could they possibly work for the EU, for Zelensky, for anything like this? They've been wiped out now militarily for some time. And I absolutely despise it when the pro-Russian types, my allies, say things like the neo-Nazi Ukrainian government. No national socialist would ever take any of these courses. The militias had a different government been in power, the militias may have had a much better, I have a book out called Ukrainian Nationalism, and I deal with a lot of this and the sources of Ukrainian nationalism. And it's no different than Russian nationalism. It has no more, it has the same right to exist as Russian or Belarusian or anything else. But when you harness it to this globalized oligarchy, these guys are getting their money from the same globalized oligarchy, it's a different story. It doesn't add up, but when it comes down to it, it's all they had at the time. I understand the confusion, though, and I hope I explain it in those two books anyway, as best I can. I hope I get the point across as to how this could be, or how in Donetsk you could have a picture of Lenin next to Nicholas II. And you could be reading the most wonderful nationalist point of view on the economy or something. And the very last sentence, it says, "Long live the revolution of 1917." It is bizarre, but that's very specific to the Russian history and Russian and Ukrainian history. And that's where we at, where we are right now. I don't know how. The actual mechanisms by which these groups were, they were just pure anti-Russian, as if to say that the Soviet Union was Russian, which it was not. They have no problem with Poland. They have no problem with, Bandera had a lot of problems with the West, had a lot of problems with the Western world. He predicted that maybe something like this may happen, that the West may manipulate our nationalist forces. And of course, he was right. And I do mention that, not in the recent book, but Ukrainian Nationalism, which I published back in 2019, I think. It's just a matter of complexity here. It's a matter of where the money is. And these militias, they're not quite what they said they were. But as a matter of course, as a general rule, Ukrainian nationalism has as much right to exist as the Russian one does. My position has always been, in fact, I say this in the introduction to the book, that I'm not anti-Ukrainian. I came into the Orthodox Church through Ukraine. I'm not anti-Ukrainian whatsoever. It's a beautiful, extraordinary culture. I still say they have the hottest women in the world. I'll say that. I'll fight that to the death. Ukraine is the cure to homosexuality, I think. In terms of women, they were harnessed to this state through money, and their focus was being anti-Russian now, as if to say Russians and Soviets were the same thing. And that was a lie that caught them. That was a lie that that entrapped them.
So on the Ukrainian side, it's resentment of the Soviet Union, which sort of has transferred into resentment against Russia. And I guess the Russians see it as well. The Nazis invaded Russia. And when they refer to Ukraine as Nazis, they're not so much referring to the anti-Jewishness as they are with anti-Russianness. Would that be correct to say?
Yeah, I think more or less that's correct. And you can kind of understand it. You know, but that just proves that Russia and the Soviet Union were two different things. Russia was a captive nation within the Soviet Union. Still, a lot of Russians were killed as a result. Belarus lost half its population. But for the most part, you know, so much of Ukrainian nationalism developed against the Poles, against the Catholic Poles. So they had to create a whole new story. And they're very good at that. You know, they're excellent at propaganda. They're very good at that. And you had a lot of disagreement. I'm not saying that they all jumped on the same ship, but yeah, I think that's exactly how I would put it. Yeah.
And what would you say to people that would say, well, there was this Russian minority in Ukraine and they had moved into an area and now Russia has taken over that area, and that's the equivalent of, say, a Muslim minority moving into a part of Britain, and then, say, Pakistan declaring that that's now a part of Pakistan. I mean, this is a sort of allegory that often gets put to me by people that support Russia. You know, how would you like it if a minority in your country suddenly decided that actually your country, part of your country, belonged to their majority? I mean, what would you say to that criticism there, Matt?
Well, Eastern Ukraine in the 18th century, when it was first settled, was pretty much empty. And there was a command in late 18th century under Catherine to begin to settle it. It was called New Russia. We still call it New Russia today. That's my kitten, by the way, who just knocked down another icon. It's I understand the point of view, but it's way too simplistic. The Russians created the industry there. Ukrainians did not. Even if that wasn't true, these are ancestors. These are ancestors of these people. Who, you know, again, my position is like Gogol's position. I have no problem with Ukrainian independence. But it should be like Belarus's independence, working together with Russia and Belarus and Central Asia to create this very prosperous Eastern economic region, the EEOC and all that. That's my point of view. I don't think it should be controlled by Russia. I think there should be close brotherly relations between the two. And that's what people sometimes are confused about. But Eastern Ukraine was empty. Ukraine, you know, was, you know, the Hetmanate under the, you know, the Cossack Hetmanate was about half of what today's Ukraine looks like. In fact, it's changed its border so many times that it's hard to tell where the border should be. The borders of today's Ukraine, or, you know, what would be considered legal Ukraine today, were purely Soviet. But in the past, in its national past, the Cossacks are the core of the national past. They didn't control that. You know, they did not control that area. They controlled areas to the south of it, in the rapids of the Zaporozhye. The Cossacks are the core of Ukraine, and they weren't. You know, some were anti-Russian, some were pro-Russian. It just depended on circumstances. So I would simply say that, you know, this wasn't, it's kind of like Rhodesia. This wasn't an invasion by any means. And it was done in a very different era. And, you know, one thing people forget that Ukrainians dominated Russian society before the Civil War. They were always overrepresented in government and elsewhere, especially in the church. That sometimes was resented, but it wasn't a problem. You know, they were respected deeply, not seen as this inferior. When you say little Russia, it doesn't mean little as in the sense of you're a little kid. You know, get out of here. I shouldn't listen to you. Like, for example, in Greece, you have little Greece and great Greece. Great Greece is in Italy. But it doesn't mean that the home country of Greece is seen as anything less. Quite the contrary. So little Russia doesn't mean, it's not an insult by any means whatsoever. It's not what it was meant to be. It created a huge number of great writers, great nationalist writers. And in some cases, in my book on Ukrainian nationalism, I go through the very good reasons that Ukrainian writers had to be anti-Russian in the 18th, 19th, 20th century, but not in the Soviet era.
I think another criticism that people might say is, well, if Russia has a much better economy and much better pensions and looks after its people much better, then clearly the Ukrainians don't want to be a part of Russia because they don't want to be a part of Russia in the West, even if Russia does have this better economy. And there are some people that say, well, Russia doesn't have a better economy. And the proof of that is that the Western Ukrainians don't want to be a part of it. So what would you say to that, Matt?
Oh, well, prior to the war, actually prior to Maidan, I went to a major polling agency in Ukraine that polled Western Ukrainians as to their views on Russia, and most of them were neutral. Many of them spoke Russian, not all of them, but some of them. Orthodoxy was a key component in there, connected them. Maybe they saw themselves as a different nation, but not necessarily opposed to the Russians whatsoever. I think Peter the Great destroyed a lot of that. Peter the Great treated Ukraine awfully, and he was a tyrant. He was a precursor of the Bolsheviks. St. Petersburg was literally built on the bones of Cossacks who were sent there to die after the Mazepa, as Mazepa went to the Swedes. And of course, unfortunately, Mazepa lost. And Sweden was never a great power again. So, you know, there is some good reason there. But that would have nothing to do with the situation today. That would have nothing to do with the modern circumstance. There was no hatred of Russia in Western Ukraine. There was some, maybe, I can't remember now. It was a long time ago. And also Western polling agencies prior to 2014, it was a very small number that actually rejected any Russian influence whatsoever, you know, hated Russia. There was a large percentage of being either neutral or pro-Russia. In fact, the overwhelming majority was one of the two. So they have a very stylized point of view. They have a very standardized point of view as to what Ukrainians thought at the time.
Well, I guess they are closely related peoples, but closely related peoples can very seriously fall out, as we learned between the British and the Irish. I just hope that we can see an end to this war over there in Ukraine. I hope that Donald Trump stops funding it. I think that's what will eventually cause it to finish, is if Trump says, well, either you accept Putin's deal and perhaps you accept rent money for the Donbass, which would help with reparations, or you're not getting any more military help from us in America. That's the only way that you can stop this war. I mean, you hear Zelensky and he'll say, oh, Putin doesn't want peace. He just bombed this part of the country. Well, no, Putin wants to win. And if you're going to have peace talks, he's going to show you what you're going to get if you don't say yes to the peace talks. It amazes me when Zelensky says that Putin doesn't want peace, he keeps bombing us. I mean, he wants to win. They've lost, you know, however many lives it is, and they want to have something at the end of it. And, you know, you can't just keep fighting and turn the place into a meat grinder. I mean, that's what it is. That's my position on it, is that Zelensky should give in to the peace demands of Putin for the good of the Russians and the good of the Ukrainians. And the sooner the better. Well, thank you very much for that today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. If you go to Amazon, you will find Dr. Johnson's book there. You'll also find a link to it in the sidebar of the Radio Albion website. And you'll also find a link to it with the article that accompanies this podcast. I will be back with more of the Daily Nationalist for you tomorrow. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.